Your community radio,
CHRY
105.5.
My mother always told me, those who live in glass houses shall not throw stones. Real talk. Our education getting robbed by the government. You get your check, you getting robbed by the government. Our native people got robbed by the government. Who really did these? They portray us, you and me. Hit the working class getting robbed by the government. Poor people evicted for condos and luxury. The truth by media get robbed cause of government. Who really did these? They show you once. They calling me a thief, charging me with robbery and breach of the peace. But can we take a look upon these beasts? They the ones that come and shoot us down in the streets and step days back to the clowns from the east. I'm talking about Europeans, English and French. Came to this land, found man, made friends and enslaved them. Took advantage of trust and then raped them. Old Canada, the land stolen from the natives and First Nations. People driven to starvation. They kidnapped their children, put them in the placements. Forced assimilation, it's like slave breaking. Now enough of them is sniffing glue and staying wasted. Just another race erased, more recent. They thinking that this minimum wage is decent. Taking 15% off the checks we receiving. We can't go to school cause we banned for no reason. Education getting robbed by the government. What? You get your check, you getting robbed by the government. Our native people got robbed by the government. Who really the thieves? They portray us, you and me. Hit the working class getting robbed by the government. Poor people evicted for condos and luxury. The truth by media get robbed cause of government. Who really the thieves? They show you on TV. The same schools assholes make schools traps that'll leave you with a case before class. Trouble waiting on the ass for you to get out of the bin. Cause with a criminal record you can't get employment. So they stay employed. No takers in the courthouse to go and inform the snort makers in the courthouse. Who go and inform the principal and the staff too. Till you and your boys ain't allowed in the classroom. Now that's robbery. So how could the queen represent my country and charge me with larceny? Further with the fuckery, it's hard to be humble when I see what they do in the region and jungle. TCHC trying to come up on the double. History repeats itself. It's no puzzle. It's exactly what happened to Africville when they move all the blacks to the helm and they can't be for real. Education getting robbed by the government. What? You get your check, you getting robbed by the government. Our native people got robbed by the government. Who really the thieves? They portray us, you and me. Hit the working class getting robbed by the government. Poor people evicted for condos and luxury. The truth by media get robbed cause of government. Who really the thieves? They show you on TV.
Radio Basics, we're back. You're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM. For our feature interview tonight, we'll be speaking with Russell Diabo, a member of the First Nations Strategic Policy Council and the editor of its publication, the First Nations Strategic Bulletin, which is now in its 10th year of publication. The First Nations Strategic Policy Council is a network of practitioners in First Nations law and policy, a body that has been highly critical of the Canadian government's policy towards Indigenous peoples. Russell Diabo is also a spokesperson for the Defenders of the Land, a network of Indigenous activists and communities from across the colonial state of Canada, founded in late 2008. Defenders of the Land asserts the right to self-determination of Indigenous nations, and by scanning through some of the back issues of Russell Diabo's First Nations Strategic Bulletin, you can get an idea of why this is necessary. By day, he also works as a policy analyst and a consultant for various bands and First Nations organizations, and he is also a member of the Mohawk Nation of Ganawage. Russell, thank you so much for being on the show with us tonight.
Thank you.
You know, it's a real pleasure to have you on. You know, since discovering the First Nations Strategic Bulletin a little earlier this year, I've been really eager to have you on the show with us. You know, and I wasn't quite expecting that the First Nations would be hitting the headlines again in the way that they are with the housing crisis in Attawapiskat. You know, of course, which has been a long time in the making. And of course, the crises like these are always in the background, being actively ignored or not just ignored, but, you know, are the consequence of contemporary and past colonial policies of the Canadian government. Just before we get into some of these issues, though, I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit about the history of the First Nations Strategic Policy Council and the publication for which you're an editor.
Well, we started basically a network of us that, you know, have been working in the area of policy and law affecting First Nations.
Mm-hmm.
Because we didn't think the Assembly of First Nations at the time, we're talking 2002, 2003,
yeah,
were being too effective in opposing this suite of legislation that the Chrétien government was bringing in, the First Nations Governance Act and you know, there was a Financial Institutions Act, a number of bills that they were, they quoted a suite because there were several pieces of legislation. Mm-hmm. And we didn't think enough information was getting out to the people and communities about that, so I started it up with people that I knew and got different contributors and basically kept it going, you know, as a volunteer effort to get alternative views of policy and law affecting First Nations, primarily in Canada, mm-hmm. you know, to get people thinking about these issues because they are complicated.
And yeah, I was just scrolling through some of the back issues today. I see that you now have, you know, almost 50 of these publications spanning nearly a decade. So congratulations to that. You know, you've clearly put down a lot of important analysis, and you know, you documented this history over the last 10 years and further back. You know, while on the question of, you know, the Assembly of First Nations, I'm wondering if you'd be able to speak a little bit more about, you know, your thoughts on the state of Indigenous representation and political formations in Canada today, you know, from the Assembly of First Nations to the band councils as they exist, you know, which I guess can be contrasted to the various forms of, you know, traditional and Indigenous democratic structures that are often so much in contradiction by these imposed by the Canadian state.
Well, to understand the situation of First Nations representation, you really have to go into the history of the Indian Act, which, you know, was adopted in 1876. And the Indian Act sets out, you know, basically the relationship between Indians and the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And that act controlled all aspects of Indian life. It's, that act is still in place today.
Yeah.
It's been amended from time to time. In fact, in the 1920s, it was amended to ban Indian ceremonies and meetings and Indians even hiring lawyers until 1951. So there was a whole generation, you know, that basically had to go underground. And a lot of material culture was seized in by the RCMP, you know, wampum belts.
Mm-hmm.
They padlocked the longhouses at Six Nations and other Iroquois reserves. They went onto the West Coast and took, you know, things from their big houses out there, their longhouses, masks, ceremonial masks. They went on the prairies and took headdresses, you know, pipes and many other things.
Yeah.
All things which are, you know, symbols of governance. It was, you know, an effort to assimilate. Because
mm-hmm.
the Indian Act is a schizophrenic thing, you know. It's, on the one hand, it was to protect Indians, you know, until they could be so-called fit for civilization, you know, mm-hmm. to be citizens. But on the other hand, it was to assimilate them.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, in terms of governance, it set up this band council system of chief and councils. And really, it's an indirect rule system, you know, basically of the British government, where the chief and councils kind of took over from what were Indian agents before, you know, as mm-hmm. programs and services were devolved to be administered by local band councils.
Mm-hmm.
But they have to report to Ottawa for how they spend, not to the people.
Yeah.
And so that system of control and management from the center, from Ottawa, has been in place for decades, you know, even over a century, really. And, you know, in 1969, they proposed repealing the Indian Act and amending the British North America Act to remove any reference to Indians, because
mm-hmm.
they argued that basically the problem with why Indians were in poverty and that was because they weren't equal to other Canadians. And, you know, most First Nations across the country react saying, well, what about our Aboriginal treaty rights?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're trying to remove all reference to us. And although they didn't like the Indian Act,
yeah,
they knew that if it was removed, there would be no recognition at all by the Canadian state of Indigenous rights. So that led to the formation of modern political organizations like the National Indian Brotherhood, which became the Assembly of First Nations.
Mm-hmm.
That was formed in the 1970s to fight the White Paper policy.
Yeah, which itself had, you know, had as one of its goals was to, you know, under the pretenses of creating equality, which is really assimilation and elimination of getting rid of the Indian Act. Is that right?
Yeah, that was part of the White Paper proposals.
Yeah.
And, of course, the organizations were formed, you know, all the ones in Ontario, Union of Ontario Indians and all them were formed about then.
Mm-hmm.
And what the government did was they said, okay, well, we'll fund you to represent yourselves, and they started giving the organizations funding, what they called core funding, so that they could then present their views to government. And in the end, you know, it was a, what the government eventually did was say, okay, well, we'll continue funding you if you consult your people about our proposals. So they basically transformed what were initially our organizations, you know, to represent or advocate our views as First Nations to the government, into being consultative bodies of the government.
So this is less, far less of, you know, political bodies that are representing Indigenous peoples within Canada, but representing the aims of the Canadian state via, you know, Indigenous peoples, figureheads within Indigenous communities.
Well, they did that through transforming the terms and conditions of the funding.
Yeah.
And it goes from the AFN right down to the band councils, because the band offices across the country, any funding that goes in there has strings attached to it on how you can spend or how you can't spend money. You know, this whole situation with Attawapiskat illustrates that, that, you know, they're basically, you know, funded to deliver programs and services, which are essentially contracts with the government and the band. And often they don't have enough money to meet the needs of the people, because the funding is capped, for one thing. It doesn't even meet the, you know, the rate of inflation or population growth. And they have to fund, you know, social assistance, health, housing, education, very little money for economic development there. It's basically just keeping people in a state of poverty, most of those programs. I don't know the details, you know, of the allegations about Attawapiskat spending, or, you know, what money they're getting from De Beers or not getting, but, you know, I do know the third-party management system isn't the solution, because it takes, you know, that's what the government did at Attawapiskat. They basically took the decision-making authority from the chief and council of having any say over, although they were in co-management, that was, you know, they had some say in prioritizing how the federal spending would be, you know, used at the local level. You know, which houses would be renovated first, or, you know, repaired or replaced or whatever with the limited budgets they had.
And of course, when these problems are presented, this crisis, like the latest crisis in Attawapiskat, is presented in the media, it's done so decontextualized from the very important, you know, reality that Indigenous peoples, for the most part, in Canada, do not have control over their lands, to exercise over their treaty lands, over their lands claims, in order to actually have the resources to do what they will, to exercise self-determination and use those resources for their national development.
Well, not just land claims. I mean, community life. You know, from womb to tomb, basically under the Indian Act, the minister has discretionary authority over all aspect of life. You know, the residential schools are just a tip of the iceberg. That's what everybody's been focusing on. But really, you know, governance, you know, everything to do with management of reserve lands is all controlled by the Department of Indian Affairs and ultimately the minister. And that colonial relationship still exists. I mean, that's why there's a big gap, I guess you could say, between leadership and membership, or the band chief and council and the band office and the people that they elect them in to, you know, lead them, is that, again, Ottawa decides, you know, how the money is to be used and spent, and the people have no say, really, very little say.
And that relationship becomes also really clear in places like Barrier Lake, where you have the community, you know, actively resisting and pushing out that imposed band council for failing to defend the community's interest.
Well, actually, the situation in Barrier Lake is, I guess, you could say, like the miners' canary, because they were one of 16 bands across the country that were, like, true custom bands. They have a system where they had reversion to custom, and a few hundred bands went into that, where they were in the elective system and went in back to some form of a customary system, but it was really an adaptation of the Indian Act elective system. But Barrier Lake was a true customary governance system, and they had negotiated an agreement outside of the land claims process in 1991, over 10,000 square kilometers of their traditional territory. Basically, it was to be a co-management agreement, and the government tried to kill that agreement off, you know, time and again, and Barrier Lake kept blocking the logging companies from cutting and forcing the governments back to the table so that, you know, there could be development on the territory. And, you know, for 15 years they went through that. Finally, the government couldn't kill the agreement, so what they did was they, you know, supported factions in the community to take out the traditional faction in order to replace them with an Indian Act elective group that would just focus on programs and services and not talk about land rights. Mm-hmm. In other words, bury those agreements that were signed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a historic process of, you know, the Department of Indian Affairs, because ultimately, you know, the bureaucracy is the permanent government. You know, liberals and conservatives and them come and go, but the bureaucracy is always there.
Mm-hmm.
And what they've always done is they've always gone and targeted what they call traditional elements within First Nation societies and worked at what they call progressive, or the collaborators,
mm-hmm.
you know, who the department basically finds leaders that will work with them and promote their ideas and sell them to their people. And they've identified some bands as being progressive bands and the other ones as being traditional bands and more backward. And those are the ones like Barrier Lake, you know, who, you know, defend their language and culture and ties to the land. Those are the ones the government targets to try and get out of the way, because then they can't get access to forest and mineral resources and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And Barrier Lake, you know, was able to get an agreement outside of their land claims process, so the feds didn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the province, you know, Quebec didn't like it because, you know, they were having to let the Algonquins have more say over resource management decisions in the territory, and they didn't like that. So they worked together to use the police, you know, to take out the traditional government and put it in place with basically a puppet regime that doesn't even operate in the community. They operate out of the town of Maniwaki,
mm-hmm.
or in Val-d'Or, you know, a couple of towns, you know, hundreds of kilometers away,
mm-hmm.
by remote control. Same thing that they're doing with Attawapiskat. I mean, the third-party manager is not even there. I think he's in Winnipeg.
Yeah. And at that, getting paid, what, $1,200 a day? Something like that?
Something like that. That's what's been reported. But that's not unusual, I think, for Barrier Lake. They're in third-party management. And I think it's actually the same third-party manager.
Wow.
And I know that the third-party manager was getting hundreds of thousands of dollars a year for managing their administration. Because they have no say over the money, plus they got a puppet regime that's working with the government. So
yeah.
It was basically a coup d'etat at Barrier Lake. But, you know, you can look across the country and see where, if the government doesn't like leadership, they'll work to take them out.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, something I wanted to ask you a little bit later about, we can get back to, is the, you know, the surveillance that you disclosed in your last issue of First Nations Strategic Bulletin, detailing the countrywide surveillance program of Indigenous peoples by the Harper regime. But before that, you know, looking more at the Harper regime, currently, and in fact, all regimes of the Canadian state historically, I'm interested to know a little bit more about the relationship between the Indian Act and the, you know, the treaty processes. You know, many, since Attawapiskat hit the headlines, you know, many a bleeding heart liberal have called for the dismantling of the Indian Act, you know, because of its history of oppression, as if, you know, we can just move past that history with the elimination of that legal framework. And which has certainly been genocidal in the ways that you've described. But these arguments and calls are, you know, sorely overlooking the national character and the asserted self-determination rights of Indigenous peoples. I'm wondering if you can comment on the Harper government's policy right now in relation to Indigenous peoples. Particularly, you know, earlier in the year we saw that they changed the name of Indian Affairs to Aboriginal Affairs. Does that signal that they themselves may be trying to get out the Indian, push away the Indian Act as a way of liquidating the national, you know, question of Indigenous peoples in the country?
Well, I think the federal government, whether it's, you know, under a red or a blue flag,
yeah,
you know, liberal or conservative, their objectives are the same. It's just the conservatives step on the gas pedal a little more than the liberals.
Yeah.
But they both are out to assimilate and terminate, you know, Indigenous rights, in my view.
I might even add to that NDP, but that might be a conversation for a different day.
Yeah, they've never been in power, so they've never shown that. But provincially, NDP governments are just as bad.
Yeah.
But, you know, the whole idea of getting rid of the Indian Act isn't, like I said, it was in the white paper that was proposed to repeal it. And then, of course, we had the new Constitution come in the 1980s with Section 35, which recognizes and affirms the existing Aboriginal treaty rights of Aboriginal peoples.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a series of First Minister's conferences on Aboriginal matters with the premiers and the prime minister in the 80s to try and, you know, identify and define what those rights mean. Those talks ended in failure, you know, and it fell to the courts to start interpreting Section 35 through different legal tests that they set out through different court cases. So, you know, asserting Aboriginal treaty rights has become a complicated process of having to analyze a number of court cases which set up a legal framework to analyze, you know, these rights to determine if a particular group who's asserting them actually have them.
Mm-hmm.
And it costs millions of dollars to collect the evidence and to sustain constitutional arguments in court to defend them. And the government knows that, you know, most groups are in poverty and can't afford, you know, that kind of, you know, a judicial approach to defending their rights. So we end up seeing blockades and other things on the ground because people, you know, get frustrated and take action there.
Mm-hmm.
And the government uses the police and that to bring them in. So, again, the Indian Act is part of the tools the government used to justify what they're doing. If you're off reserve, then you're saying you don't have rights off reserve. The rights you do have are on reserve, and those are defined by the Act. Because the Constitution, Section 35, is vague, and the government takes advantage of that uncertainty, legal and political uncertainty, about what Section 35 means. Yet it's supposed to be the highest law of the land in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
What they're trying to do is force groups to negotiate under their unilaterally developed policies of land claims and self-government.
Yeah.
Because they're saying if you want out of the reserve system in the Indian Act, then you have to negotiate, you know, through our self-government and land claims policies.
Which
turns bands into municipalities, basically.
Yeah, which you also detailed in one of your more recent editions of the newsletter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, but getting back to getting rid of the Indian Act, I mean, Sean Atleo has proposed this himself.
Yeah.
But he didn't just come out of it with nowhere. That was one of the main recommendations of the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, which came out in 1996, which basically said the whole relationship between Canada and Aboriginal peoples has to change, and there needs to be changes in the machinery of government. In other words, new departments created in Ottawa that would be more reflective of, more fair-based relationship in terms of governance and land rights, you know, recognizing self-determination and accommodating it within the Canadian Federation.
Uh-huh.
And there were a whole series of recommendations around that which were shelved.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a conservative government, actually, was the Mulroney government after OCA in 1990 that commissioned that Royal Commission, but it issued its report in 1996 when a Liberal Chrétien government was there, and they said, oh, we're doing this already. Plus, you're recommending, you know, spending more money. We're not going to do that. So they shelved that report. So all those recommendations, which cost about $60 million, you know, that's about what the process cost. They had 440 recommendations, which was just put on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
But the national chief picked up some of those ideas and said, well, we should get rid of the Indian Act because it's part of the problem, which is true.
Yeah.
And, you know, Ottawa should restructure the treaty relationship and Aboriginal rights and that into new government departments that would, you know, be more reflective of, you know, what the courts have said about how Aboriginal mm-hmm. treaty rights need to be accommodated in Canada. But, of course, it's a double-edged sword, right?
Mm-hmm.
Getting rid of the Indian Act, Harper, I'm sure, would love to see that gone.
But as a means to assimilation or as a means to national liberation, right?
No, as a means to assimilation and getting rid of the government expenditures. Because in my view, the Ottawa bean counters, you know, are always looking at the increase in the number of status Indians. And I think that's why they keep making changes to the membership sections where they're trying to eliminate or reduce the number of status Indians because to them, you know, a reduction in number of status Indians means a reduction in federal spending requirements.
Yeah.
And arguably one could say that's why they're keeping conditions on reserve so bad, so that there'll be an off-reserve migration.
Yeah, it's a self-liquidation, right? Well, which is forceful. Yeah.
If they can get them off the reserves, then they become provincial responsibilities in the ghettos and the cities.
Yeah.
And so then the provinces have to pay for them, not the feds. And I think that's, you know, I think what's really behind a lot of the capping of the funding that the Liberals did and the Conservatives have maintained and are even stepping up. But, you know, there is to be a meeting between the leadership, you know, Assembly First Nations, the National Chiefs organize that, and Prime Minister Harper on January 24th.
Yeah.
And the National Chiefs have been calling for a reset of the relationship.
Yeah, we're hearing
But
this.
We keep seeing what the Prime Minister's approach is, so I'm not sure how that meeting is going to turn out, but I think that, you know, the people have expectations because, you know, for too long there they've been marginalized and kept in poverty because their land rights aren't being recognized, and, you know, there isn't enough program funding to address their real needs. So I think that if this meeting in January doesn't produce any results, that probably it will turn into another hot summer.
So then, you know, yourself being a vocal activist, leading figure, outside the prescribed boundaries that are set out by the colonial government and its, you know, puppet structures, I'm interested to know what your thoughts are then on how we actually move forward. You know, our organization being a people's organization as well, very interested in people's struggles from one organization to another. How do we actually move forward with advancing the interests of Indigenous people's struggles for self-determination and, you know, national liberation?
Well, that was one of my recommendations when they did a strategy session, you know, last week at the Assembly of First Nations, was that they should include the people into anything that they're planning on doing with the Prime Minister, because, you know, they need a role in letting the Prime Minister know that they're fed up too. You know, whether it's demonstrations or rallies or whatever, you know, going on Ottawa when they hold the meeting. But following that, I think, you know, ultimately it does come down to the people making themselves aware.
Yeah.
Because really when you see the dysfunction that exists amongst First Nations leadership, it's reflective of dysfunctions in the communities.
Absolutely.
And a lot of that goes to the fact that we haven't controlled our own education, and our traditional forms of, you know, knowledge have been, you know, interfered with by the outside for many generations.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of young people now that I would say aren't really sure of their identities.
Mm-hmm.
Not through any fault of their own.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you see that across the country with people dropping out of the educational system and not really having any alternatives, and, you know, the statistics are there, you know, with getting involved in petty crime and things like that.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a real, I guess, social problem. How do you deal with that as leaders, you know? It really comes down to the people having to get involved and take responsibility for their own kids and that, too.
Yeah.
And that's a big social change. I mean, if you look around the world at everything going on with the Arab Spring and all this other political movements that are happening, it's interesting to see within Canada, amongst First Nations, we're probably the least motivated to change. And a lot of that has to do with the conservatism that exists, you know, amongst our leadership, because they're afraid if they do anything, their dependence on federal funding, that they'll be cut. You know, like what they're seeing in Attawapiskat, you know. You make noise, you get punished, right?
And maybe, you know, to be fair as well, we have to recognize that, you know, colonized peoples, not only Indigenous peoples, but displaced peoples who come here to, you know, the core of the very core of the imperialist beast in the world is, you know, I think those of us who are closest to the very center have to deal with, you know, very sophisticated systems of management to co-opt, you know, deflect, resist, and ultimately crush our resistance when we actually attempt to make change. You know?
Well, there's no question in Canada and the U.S. that's the case.
Yeah.
I mean, with the U.S. tribes, it's the same as, you know, Canadian First Nations. You know, I've lived and worked on both sides, and, you know, I'm pretty familiar with what's going on the American side as well.
Mm-hmm. Russell, thank you so much for being on the show with Radio Basics here. We're out of time for the evening, but you know, we really look forward to talking with you soon again if we can.
Sure, no problem.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Russell.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
Yeah, you too. Bye.
That was Russell Diablo, the publisher and editor of First Nations Strategic Bulletin. He is also a member of the Mohawk Nation of Ganawagi. Radio Basis. We're going to go to commercial break, and we'll be right back to wrap up the show for tonight.
You're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM, your community radio.
Basics, we're back. CHRY 105.5. You know, one of the, just to wrap up the show, one of the important points I think that Russell made. And is also, like, in the two organizations he represents, the one, the new...
Defenders of the Land and the First Nations Strategic Policy Council.
Yeah, the Strategic Policy Council was the name I was looking for. But yeah, Defenders of the Land specifically, I mean, I'm on the website right now, and one really central point they make in their basis of unity and their explanation of their goals and objectives is, you know, not being tied to government and corporate funding, being a truly independent people's organization, in this case an Definitely. Indigenous people's organization. And recognizing the role of the fundamental oppressive role the Canadian state, colonial role the Canadian state plays in regards to Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. And you know, you mentioned in the last question there the similarities that us being Basic Community Newsletter, the various organizations that are also present on the show, you know, Barrio Nuevo, Justice for Aoi, et cetera, being people's organizations, being mass groups and organizations that are similarly recognized the fundamental parasitic and oppressive role of the Canadian state and are defending the interests, you know, not necessarily there's a small population of Indigenous people within Toronto, the Toronto area, but the various other racialized, oppressed, poor, working people within this context, and for Indigenous people and other oppressed peoples within this colonial entity, really need to there's a real need to forge stronger links of unity and solidarity that are beyond just, you know, people traveling up to the reserves to provide, you know, solidarity to that movement without building movements of their own, which is in fact in the end more beneficial, right? If there's strong people's movements within the so-called, you know, settler or immigrant populations in Canada, that's going to mean that much more in terms of confronting the Canadian state. Right,
definitely. We all have
with Indigenous movements.
We all have our distinct but complementary contradictions in relation to the Canadian state. Right, you know, I think the vast majority of immigrants who come here are, you know, have been adversely affected overall by the policies of governments like Canada around the world through neoliberal globalization, which is a policy of imperialism of the stronger countries dominating the economically. Militarily weaker countries. You know, people are displaced because whether you're a professional in Egypt or in the Philippines or in Colombia or in India who cannot find a job within his or her own economy because the national stunted or distorted in order to build ports and roads leading between, you know, the
factories
and the port for the sake of, you know, export processing or the development is just laying out a road so that the big dump trucks can get to the mining companies, sites of exploration and extraction. That's not national development. It's development that facilitates the exploitation and plunder of these countries. So by and large, we're not creating, you know, third world countries today, which are, I think we can call them semi-colonial. They're semi-colonized. Within the framework of the IMF and the World Bank and even the United Nations, they do not have economic policies that develop the country for the sake of meeting the needs of the people. They have economic policies and development policies that serve global capitalism, which is why so many migrants are you know, chasing their wealth around the world to countries like Canada, U.S., European countries, exactly. So on and so forth.
Yeah. And oftentimes, you know, when they arrive here and there's somewhat of, I mean, that is not always the case. And, you know, we saw that event on Thursday, you know, women who had immigrated here from places like Jamaica and actually the violence they were experiencing here
is worse.
The police from the state was worse.
Much
right?
worse.
It was worse. Like they're having their sons nearly killed, nearly taken from them by the police, right? Yeah. But overall, immigrants coming here, and we know this story repeats itself, and somewhat amelioration of their living conditions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the thought process there, which is not entirely logical, is that yeah, this is a land of opportunity, or this is a place where, you know, if people pull themselves up or you know, stick to the straight and narrow, they can succeed and advance mm-hmm. in the society. And particularly, unfortunately, coming from immigrants and other racialized oppressed people, there's a perception of indigenous forces, there's a perception of other, you know, populations that have lived here for longer periods of time,
mm-hmm.
That are more criminalized, that are more, let's say, you know, kicked out of the school system, whatever, and filing, you know, resisting, filing complaints against the Canadian state, that somehow they're just complaining, they're not pulling themselves up, you know?
Yeah.
And not understanding all the other relationships that go into that. I mean, similarly, you made the point with someone else, let's say, you know, Russian Jewish immigrants traveling to Israel and talking about that as a land of opportunity, which it somewhat might be for them in terms of the amelioration of their conditions, but not understanding the fundamental colonial nature of that state in relation to Palestinians.
Yeah. Or I think even a better example is East African Jews, right,
yep.
who
yeah,
are displaced
exactly.
from their
exactly.
own countries and actually become the bottom of Israeli society, right?
Yeah.
Anyways, all that to say that there are a lot of us have our own contradictions with the Canadian state, which is a colonial and imperialist state. And, you know, we got to find ways to get together with all the peoples, indigenous peoples, migrant workers, you know, new Canadians, recent immigrants, and working class people and you know, square up against those contradictions and lead a fight for liberation, you know?
No doubt. And just to sign off, you know, as people are coming together over the holidays, and as we're always told, we really need to start rejecting these bourgeois notions of at this point in time, you know, being thankful for all that we have, and, you know, somehow whether
state,
a higher power or whether the government or whatever measly scraps that we've been given or slaved our lives for, you know, we should be somehow thankful and grateful for this. No, I mean, let's be thankful and grateful for the support from our, you know, other family members that we've given ourselves. From our children, our parents, whatever,
mm-hmm.
let's be thankful
mm-hmm.
for that. But, you know, this should really be a point in time, you know, coming on the cusp of a new year. Let's look towards the problems, identifying the problems and the issues we continue to deal with, and how to actively and effectively confront and change that situation.
Definitely,
to not just
definitely.
Be content with what we have, because that's becoming less and less every year. As this recession comes, as a Christmas present, you know, they not only put in a new crime bill that's going to put how many people, you know, locked up for longer and further. We have, you know, increasing mm-hmm. layoffs mm-hmm. in the city. Like, what the measly scraps that we have that we're supposed to be thankful for become less and less every year. So let's not be just content with what we have. Let's strive for more. Let's strive for a better society and a better world.
Definitely. And, you know, just to finish up on that, like, to recognize that to the extent that Canada is a wealthy country or the standard of living is much higher than that which we can compare with other countries, like we've been discussing in this whole show, we got to recognize that is land that is stolen, that is continues to be stolen and plundered and exploited. So, you know, I was actually recently at a Friday prayer at a masjid, at one of the mosques, and the imam was just talking about how, you know, like, there's a lot of problems in Canadian society. We got to struggle to make it better, but we got to recognize that we are in one of the best countries in the world. And, you know, the point, I saw some of the points that he was making, but yeah, and he certainly identified some of the very serious problems in the society, but I took issue with that one point based on the fact that we got to recognize that what I said to him later is that, like, you know, if Canada can be called one of the best societies in the world, then we can also say that of Israel,
yeah,
right?
Well, that's
which
the,
is that land that is being stolen and then given to settlers who are being encouraged. You know, I walk out of the radio station here, I see there's posters up being promoted by some Zionist organization saying, you know, take your free trip to Israel. Your land that's rightfully yours. And this is being advertised to Canadians. This is being advertised to people who have never been to Israel, to yeah. Jews, you know, Jewish peoples. And the same thing with Canada, right? You know, people think that are told that Canada is a promised land, the land of bread and honey. But we got to recognize that, you know, link up your relationship between, you know, you being displaced from one part of the world or another over to Canada. And then when you get here, you know, look into the situation of the colonized peoples here and the struggles that they're going through. And if we're actually going to make liberation for ourselves here and for our peoples back at home, we got to link up with oppressed people everywhere.
Most definitely. So I think that's it for this week's Ready Basics.
We got Vaughn waiting, we got Vince waiting to come on with Every Night I Have the Blues.
We'll be back next Monday. You know, happy holidays to everyone, whatever you're celebrating, just whether you're just
taking
time
a break
with your family. Happy holidays to the, you know, the dozens that are going to be in unheated tents out in Attawapiskat. To the 60, you know, youth, young men and women that are going to be spending this Christmas in jail as a result of those raids.
Yeah.
You know, to the hundreds of city workers who just got laid off. To all of us that are dealing with this miserable Canadian state, but you know, somehow find a way to
keep struggling, man.
Exactly.
Keep your head up.
Exactly.
You know. All right, Radio Basics. Check us out every Monday, 8 to 9 p.m. and at basicsnews.ca. Much love, Toronto. Enjoy the break, the holidays, if you got one.
We're out.